Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, my hometown. This was the week when the weather turned. It just came all of a sudden. This last week, the wind shifted around from the north, and you could feel it. The temperature dropped about 20 degrees, I think, in just an hour or two. Felt like your father had just come into the room. You'd been in the midst of a fantasy, and your father walked into the room and said, "Okay, come on, let's go. We got work to do." And out you went to do whatever had to be done. I went up there to the Chatterbox Cafe, and I ran into my Uncle Dean, who said that they had to bring their dock in. They hadn't done it yet. Well, I knew I was trapped then. I'm an older guy until I go up to Lake Wobegon, and then I'm part of the youth movement. I mean, I walk into the Chatterbox Cafe, and it's full of geezers there, and they look at me with a kind of a hopeful look, thinking of the work they have to do around the place, and would I have just a moment to help them out? Well, I had to go and help my Uncle Dean and my Aunt Evelyn, and they hadn't brought their dock in yet. They should have brought it in, would have brought it in back around Labor Day, but they didn't because the weather was so beautiful in early September, so they wanted to take the boat around the lake a few more times and do a little bit more fishing now that the famous fighting sunfish are really starting to bite. And so they had left their dock in until now. It was really cold, although they said, "You know, it's not that cold," they said. They said, "You know, it'll only take a moment to go out there," and their son-in-law, Larry, was there to help, but he had a bum knee, so he couldn't wade into the water. I was the one who had to put on the swim trunks and walk out up to my waist in frigid water. They said, "It won't take but a minute," not knowing how poor my mechanical aptitude skills are, so I put on the swim trunks and I walked out into the water, pausing briefly at that point where men pause when we walk into very cold water, thinking, "Well, I'm probably not going to have any more children, so it doesn't really matter. I'm beyond caring about that." I walked in all the way up to my waist and beyond and had to pick up that dock off of the posts and wrestle it in, and Larry was there, none too sure of what we should do next, and laid it up on the shore and walked up to the front porch of the house and sat there. And I thought of that poem that goes, "Somebody said that it couldn't be done, but he with a smile replied that maybe it couldn't, but he would be one who wouldn't say so till he tried. So he buckled right in with a bit of a grin till his screwdriver touched a live wire. And he let out a cry and rose to the sky and joined the Lord's heavenly choir. The people who spoke for the eulogy spoke of duty and ambition. They spoke well of the dead, and nobody said, 'Why didn't he call an electrician?'" This is my philosophy of work, you see, is that each person does one thing or two really well, and for everything else that you do, you should hire other people to do it who do that well. This is my philosophy. There are people who earn their money wading into cold water and lifting docks and getting boats out of the water. But this is a city person's view of work, you see, specialization. This is not the Lake Wobegon view of work, which is a farmer's view of work. Farmers were generalists. They were natural aristocracy. They could handle anything that came their way. They could handle sick animals or sick people, machines, crops, everything. And work was redemptive for them, you see. This is one thing people don't understand about a small town, is that you might be really messed up and do weird things, but you could always redeem yourself if at this time of year, when they're out combining soybeans and have to do it now, they do it all night long. You can see the headlights back and forth going across the fields of beans and people driving big trucks alongside the combine until the boss waves them off. The box is full, so you drive it in into the grain terminal in town and you unload and you come back and you do it again. And if you can do this and do your job and stick with it, do it all night until the whole job is done, these people will forgive you for an awful lot. They will forgive you for more than you might believe possible. And in the case of Uncle Dean, I do have things to be forgiven for. I was staying with them when I was a kid, and he walked into the room at just the moment I was in a fantasy. I had seen a movie on television about the French Resistance. And there was a bishop who had dynamited the German rail line leading to Normandy and so had saved lives the night before D-Day. I was dressing up as the bishop. I had found my cousin's black dress. And I put it on, and one of my Aunt Evelyn's hats, which seemed to me to be like a bishop's beretta. And I was speaking to myself in what I believed to be the French language, using sort of French vowels, when my Uncle Dean walked in. Oh my gosh, he said. He had no idea that I was a hero, that I was part of the French Resistance. And there didn't seem to be much of any way to explain this to him at the time. I think that this last week I finally made it up to him in some part. My cousin Larry was there. We talked afterward. He never had been that nice to me before, but now he was because I had helped with the dock and I was cold. We sat in the house by the stove and he told me about his trip to Norway this last summer. He's a retired school teacher, never been back to Norway, back to the fatherland, because his wife didn't want to go and he kept trying to convince her. And then last spring, on a Sunday morning in the Lutheran church, he had a sort of awakening, a simple awakening. It was during the exchange of the peace, the part of the service that Lutherans don't particularly care for in Lake Wobegon, because you have to shake hands with other people and say the peace of the Lord. And it's never clear just how many people you should wish this to. Just and he was exchanging the peace with people to his left and to his right and standing right behind him. And then he looked and he saw his sister was across the aisle. He had never crossed the aisle for the exchange of peace before. Some reason he thought this was unscriptural. But there she was, and he crossed the aisle to take her hand and say, "The peace of the Lord be with you." And this just opened doors in Larry's mind so that the next week he made reservations to go to Norway. Just went there. Just went. Didn't ask anybody. He just went. He took a cheap flight by way of Reykjavik, and he landed in Oslo, and he went over to Bergen, where Grandpa had left to come to America, and he went up into the hills to meet his ancestors. It was around Midsummer Day, and they had a big Midsummer Day circle. There was a big bonfire, little boys dressed up in black knee pants and red embroidered vests and shiny black shoes, and girls with flowers in their hair. And they danced around the bonfire, and there was a pole, and they intertwined wreaths and so forth. And then they all went home, and they took off their costumes, and they put on hip-hop T-shirts, and they sat down and they watched television. He went up for a walk with his cousin Torvald. They walked up through the meadow, up high into the hills, looking down over the fjord. They walked up there, the sun still bright at 10 o'clock in the evening. They walked in silence for 2 miles up this plain, this high plateau. And they got to the end of the meadow, And they turned and they looked down into this scene of vast majesty. And Torvald said, "Yep." And this moment of silence between them, this moment of silence, Larry felt reunited with the Norwegian people in this silence. Maybe they were awed in other ways. Their lefse was not made from potatoes. It was made from wheat dough. And they put salsa on their lefse, not like grandma at all. He came from very shy Norwegian Lutherans in Lake Wobegon, the sort of people who would stay behind to clean up their own wedding reception, not rush off to the honeymoon, but make sure that everything was taken care of. These were very self-conscious people who were embarrassed at words like intersection, who people who made Jell-O in the same way that grandma and great-grandma had made it, people who felt that to put peas in a tuna noodle casserole was a little show-offy. It was a little too much. No, he felt united with his people. He felt united in that moment of silence. And then Torvald said an amazing thing. Torvald said, "You know, my mother used to make the same walk up here to the end of the meadow ever so often, whenever she could, when she was a young woman and when she was an older woman, until finally she couldn't walk anymore and she had to go into the nursing home. And so I would make this walk for Mama, and I would look and see, and then I'd go back to the nursing home and I would tell Mama what I had seen. But she didn't seem to be that interested if I described the birds and the flowers and the trees. And so I told her that I had seen a vision up here of a beautiful young woman with golden hair who floated over the grass, her bare feet just almost touching the grass, playing a harp and singing Home on the Range." And when I told Mama about this, it really perked up her interest. Mama became interested in me now that she was worried about me. She started to read about schizophrenia. It really helped Mama in a way. Larry told me this story. I said, "You know, Larry, if you want to find out who you are, you don't look to your ancestors. You look to your children. Your children are the ones who will tell you. That's the story that people our age are supposed to be interested in. Our own story doesn't interest us that much. It gets kind of boring after a while. The PSA score and the lipids and the blood pressure. Get tired of that stuff. I went over to Europe this summer, went to Prague with my family, went there to see our old au pair, Katya, who lives in Prague, and to take our current au pair, Kaya, back home to the Czech Republic. We walked around that great city. We saw the Church of St. Nicholas, which is a big whoop of a high Baroque building just not far from the bridgehead of the bridge over the Vltava and the Charles Bridge. And an amazing Baroque building. Really, your minimum annual adult requirement of the Baroque is right there in this church. All these marble cherubs that look like glazed donuts and a bishop throttling the devil and all this amazing stuff around you. We came down to a little Carmelite cloister, an old Carmelite cloister. It was an orchard. There were pear trees and apple trees. And my little girl, my sandy-haired, gap-toothed daughter, sat there between her two Czech girls, these young women whom we had hired to help our family and who became our family, sat there on either side of her. My daughter sitting and adoring them, holding their hands, imagining that she was part of their club as they talked back and forth in their odd language made up entirely of consonants, hardly a vowel to be heard. She crossed her legs as these young women crossed them. She brushed back her hair exactly as they brushed back theirs. And we walked off to a restaurant where we could eat pork and mashed potatoes and dumplings. And my little girl sat there with her Czech sisters, my wife and I sitting down at the end of the table, like servants, really, like a secretary and a treasurer. I walked around Prague thinking about my hero Franz Kafka, who wrote The Trial, his great masterpiece, Living in Prague. This man who ever so often would just sit and think about throwing himself out the window. He was so neurotic. He couldn't bear noise whatsoever. He hated crowds. He hated social events. I went off to see his houses that he'd lived in, his apartments, the Café Louvre where he'd had coffee. And I thought, you know, this man would have been so happy if he had married his fiancée, Felice Bauer, and if he just had a little girl to kind of distract him from what he was thinking about way too much. Franz Kafka, he wrote, created great art, but somehow he didn't have that happy life. He wasn't able to look on down the road and forget about himself, as you would have if you had a little girl. You sit and watch her happiness as she tucks into the pork and the dumplings. And her happiness, your happiness at seeing her happiness, is greater than anything you yourself could get from food. Your sadness at her tears is so much deeper than anything you feel anymore. We're all brought here to tell a story, the story of our parents, those ill-informed but well-meaning people who gave us our lives, and we come to a point in life, and now we're looking at our children. That's the future. That's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average.